This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the March 9th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm Mike Hogan, joined in studio by Mr. Lonnie Goldfeder. Welcome, Lonnie.
Thank you. Hello, Mike.
Good to have you back. Pete, again, is still taking a little bit of extra time off. He's currently, I think, somewhere in Southern California after having spent last week in Mexico.
He's a hard life.
I know, that poor guy.
I think they're going to have some bailout for him.
I know.
It's just really rough.
It must be awful.
Getting he's working on a tan for his beard right now.
I know.
So he's going to have streaks in his beard, like Moses coming up from Mount Sinai or whatever.
I like it. Well, he'll be back via Skype on Friday for the podcast. Joined as well via Skype by Mr. Jonathan Kinchin, as always on Friday. But thank you for joining us today. Otherwise, it would be all me by my lonesome, at least in the studio.
The Mike Hogan Show.
Yeah. Later today, I'm excited that we're going to have Kenny Peck joining us.
That's right. And he will shed some good light on the new Pace Ace and some of the changes in the daily racing form, which, you know, they're positive changes. It's more information for the player. And Kenny knows. I mean, Kenny did an excellent instructional video with Dan Ellman, and any light he could shed, any questions he could answer, you know, it's great to have him.
Yeah, I haven't talked to him since the Pace Ace feature in the DRFPPs has launched, so I'll have a few questions for him. It'll be good to get his take, at least directly from, as it were, the horse's mouth. So that'll be fun. He'll be joining us at about 30 minutes in, or a little bit less. Until then, let's talk about some of the races we saw over the weekend. We saw some good performances, and I'm going to put you on the spot right now. Did we see the Derby winner?
I don't think so. I mean, I thought that in New York, Shagoff was pretty good. He possibly could. I mean, there's no reason why I wouldn't throw him out just yet, but I don't think that we saw the Derby winner yet. I mean, I still think the two top horses are the two top horses. I mean, again, Shagoff made some nice moves against an absolutely ridiculous bias in New York, but he did nothing wrong. He's undefeated. I think you always have to respect an undefeated horse.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that in a little bit in a minute. Let's first, before we talk about the males, let's talk about the three-year-old fillies.
Okay.
There were a couple nice performances this weekend, most notably, of course, being Songbird in the Santa Isabel on Saturday at Santa Anita. I mean, what more can you say about this filly?
She does what she does, and you know, it's funny, after the race, I saw an interview with Jerry Hollendorfer. He would really like her to be tested.
Yeah.
It would be nice, because right now everything has been very easy for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would like to see her get tested, too. I know that I don't think there's any plans to run against the boys in the Triple Crown, but I don't see any reason why she shouldn't run against the boys in some other races in California. They're not overly drawn. You know, it's not going to be that physical for her. I mean, I just think for her as a racehorse, it's just too easy right now going against the usual suspects.
I mean, it's like that race was, we've seen this film before, okay? Mm-hmm. She pays 210, she goes wire to wire, wins easily, geared down at the end. She pays 210, 210, 210. Songbird wins over Land Over Sea, who I think is making a nice career of running second to Songbird. That might be what, the third or fourth time in a row?
I see it's the actually the fourth, the one, two, three, four, fifth time. The fifth time she's run behind Songbird. And, you know, so clearly she's got a good view of Songbird's back. I'll tell you that. If you want to take a picture of Songbird's tail, just talk to Land Over Sea. She can tell you all about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's like Songbird, Land Over Sea, straight exacta, five times in a row. This time it paid $2.80 for a buck, which, you know.
Well, it's five times in a row she was behind her. It's the third time in the last five races she's been second.
Okay, well, there you go. And I'm kind of with you. I'd like to see somebody test her a little bit. You know, that was a race that it seemed like she was best early. Nobody really on paper looked like they could run with her. Certainly nobody had anything close to a buyer speed figure that could compete with her. Her lowest of her five career races coming into the race was higher than anybody else in the whole field. Any of the other eight fillies in the whole field had done on their best day.
That usually equals 1-9 on the tote board, and that's what you got.
Or 1-20 in this case.
Exactly. And, you know, it's When they broke the gate, I thought, oh, these two horses are going to give her a little bit of pressure, but it really was nothing, you know. So, as you know, you like worry a little bit. Say, oh, you know, she's a superstar. You don't want to lose to these horses, but at the same time, you do want a bit of a test. She easily put away her rivals and extended her lead, and then extended it a little more, and it was a hand ride late. It was diminishing, but she was geared down late, so there was nobody really coming at her.
Yeah, I don't think she's really going to get much of a test in Southern California by any of the fillies that are currently stabled there. I think her next race is probably one more prep in Southern California before they ship to Kentucky for the Oaks. Unless an invader comes, one of these Karina Mia, Catherine Sophia, any of these fillies that we've seen on the East Coast that I don't think are as good as her, but are certainly better than any of the others that have been running behind her in Southern California. Unless she gets one of those that has a lot of good early speed, we might not see her get tested until the Oaks.
Well, somewhere, you might have to think Rabbit somewhere along the line if you can. I mean, you have to have it's always a graded stake, so the horse has to qualify. But at the same time, it's like, you know, you got to have somebody in there if you're bringing in a horse who's coming off the pace to give her some pressure. Otherwise, if she's loose on the lead, she's really hard to catch.
Yeah, most good racehorses are.
Yeah, I mean, that's why she's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, she has a pace edge, she has a class edge. You know, she's just easily defeating all of the rivals that have stepped up to take her on. So, you know, again, it becomes a question of what kind of price are you willing to take for an untested filly who has certainly done nothing wrong, but is going to face probably the best field she's faced. I mean, let's face it, even in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, she still had that field over a barrel.
Yeah. You know, it was Rachel's Valentina. We haven't heard from her.
Right.
I mean, I think she's supposed to be training soon. But
she frankly had some issues going into the race because she missed a work or two. Yeah. You know, she ran well enough to run second in that race, but you know, she wasn't really at the top of her game. She didn't come out of the race all that well because, like you said, we haven't seen anything from her since. So.
I mean, that's not a good sign. I mean,
no.
So you have to worry about the strength of the division right now. I mean, so we had that impressive maiden winner this weekend.
Yeah, and then let's talk about her for a second. You know, there was on Sunday at Gulfstream Park in the sixth race.
Right.
A filly named Lightstream.
Right, Lightstream.
Lightstream made her career debut. Harlan's Holiday filly for trainer Brian Lynch made her career debut, and in that race on Sunday at Gulfstream, earned the top buyer speed figure of any three-year-old, male or female, this year, and higher than Songbird earned in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile when she earned a 99 in her best effort, higher than Nyquist earned in the San Vicente in his career effort. So, and this was a green filly who broke slowly from the rail, never changed leads in the stretch, pulled away pretty easily late to win by 2.5 or so, and earned a buyer speed figure of 103.
So granted, it's 7 furlongs, but she did gallop out very well.
Yep.
She never changed pace, not even after the gallop out. She did beat, though, a Daughter of India,
yep,
who was also making her first start around like a 98 buyer. So in both cases, we're dealing with at least two quality fillies in this field. You know, again, if you're debuting with a 98 buyer and a 103, that's pretty impressive.
So let me ask you this. Did we see one and maybe two freak fillies in that field, or do we have maybe a questionable buyer speed figure?
I think...
Or both?
I think it might be both. I actually knew somebody who was running horse in that particular race, okay? So what was happening was they were asking me about how to play the race, and of course, in retrospect, it wasn't hard because the horse was Xena Rules, and the place to put her was the third and fourth slot because the Superfecta paid over $300 for like 10 cents or something like that.
Yeah. Playing against the other first-time starter that was getting a little overbet for Todd Pletcher.
Right. I mean, so exactly. I didn't really like that horse, to be honest with you. So, in fact, I told him that. So I had actually given him the triple, but I didn't think about the Superfecta because I knew Xena Rules was going to be running at the end.
Yeah.
So he was asking me about the race, and going into the race, I knew that we had some well-bred fillies and fillies who were fairly highly regarded. I think the Pletcher horse was highly regarded, but I didn't like her as a first-time starter at a short price. I thought some of these other horses were more interesting. I thought Lightstream, not knowing much about it, but knowing it's Brian Lynch, and also seeing the money she was getting, mm-hmm, she was a no-brainer use because she was on the rail, 7-1. I just felt like like she was taking a lot of money. She was getting bet in the picks. So, and obviously Karina was a use, and I think there was one of the worst that was
Jay Latosh.
And it was Jay Latosh. That's right.
One other thing we'll mention about Lightstream: the Clocker Report, the DRF Clocker Report, noticed or mentioned that she was working with and outworking older stakes horse Hammer's Terror.
Right.
So when you have an unraced 3-year-old filly working with an older one and a good older one and outworking them, that's kind of a sign that they're ready to fire first
out. Right. They clearly mature above their experience, you know, their years, so to speak, in terms of racing.
It'll be interesting to see what comes next for that filly because, you know, she's green. She could move forward, especially if she changes leads next out.
Right.
Stretch out. Yeah. I'm thinking in maybe a stakes race, she'll probably get bet pretty heavily off of that 103 buyer speed figure, and maybe she shows up next against Catherine Sophia.
And that's where the interesting, you know, possible rivals to Songbird are going to be coming
from. For sure.
So if you get a Catherine Sophia, you know, you put Karina and Lightstream in the mix. These are horses with upside. And, you know, again, Karina was on the lead. I don't know how fast she was really going, but because I can't totally always trust the Gulfstream clock.
Yeah.
But I think these are horses with potential. Obviously, Songbird has the foundation.
Right.
She's run as a 2-year-old. She's the best 2-year-old in the country.
Right.
Right now, the best 3-year-old. But, you know, these are the up-and-comers, and they're looking for that title, and they have talent, and that's important. She hasn't seen them, and if somebody could show up in Kentucky and maybe challenge her there, you know, this is where it gets interesting. And also Churchill Downs.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different kind of track, and that also is a variable for a horse that's never run over it.
Well, yeah, and it tends to be, look, Songbird's gone wire to wire in most of her races. She's just faster early and she's just better late. At Santa Anita, that works pretty well because it tends to be, it's not a highway necessarily, but it tends to be a speed favoring track.
You know, when they got those big days though at Churchill, they'll do the same thing.
Yeah.
So on Oaks Day and Derby Day, you always see a souped up track too. So unless it's raining or something.
Yeah.
That might also favor her. But, you know, you watch the races before the day and see how it's playing, and maybe there'll be something to make her more vulnerable. But I think in terms of looking to beat her, you're going to have to look East Coast.
I think even still, those fillies are kind of up against it a little. But that said, I'm curious to see how a horse like Lightstream does in her second career start.
Right.
It seems like there's a bit of talent there.
And also the extended stretch out for Catherine Sophia. Let's see what she does. She's done nothing wrong.
Right.
So it'll
right.
be interesting to see.
You know, I'm not one to question the buyer team very often, but I do think that the 103 may be, you know, a bit ambitious, perhaps.
I thought so too. I was surprised to see it. You know, when you asked me to look at the race, I looked at it and I said, "Well, you know, these horses are okay." I said, "The horse never changed lead. She made a really nice move. I saw Karina on the lead. I thought, well, this horse looks like she might be home. But then, you know, Lightstream for a horse that was very green and you know, on her first start, and she was keen. She definitely the race set up nicely for her.
Yeah.
I thought. But she did what she had to do. And when a horse does, it's more impressive for a horse to win a race, their first race coming off the pace, than going wire to wire sometimes. And, and she had to still maneuver through horses, which is always impressive.
And she broke slow. I mean, she had to do a little bit of extra work. And you're right. I mean, and look, the figure, she got a 103. It was the same as what Blofeld got in winning the Gulfstream Park Handicap the day before. Granted, he was going a mile, but it was still a one-turn dirt sprint. So that's worth taking note of. All right, let's talk boys. We talked a little bit about the Gotham and Shagoff running against what you mentioned was, by all accounts that I've seen, a pretty strong bias towards early speed. Speed was holding very well on Saturday at Aqueduct.
And the rail.
Any
horse on the rail on Saturday at Aqueduct had a tremendous advantage. And that made Lauban a really good price at 15.
Sure.
I kind of liked the horse a little bit going in anyway because he had shown talent. He had a horribly wide trip the race before. So I was going to use him regardless. But once the rail bias and the early speed bias like presented itself, he was a no-brainer.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Shagoff broke best and was, prior to the first call, it's not listed in the charts, you won't see it, actually had the early lead. Then Irid took him back a little bit. He was at one point on the backstretch, maybe third or fourth. But going into the first turn, I thought Shagoff may actually outrun Lauban. But he got eased back a little bit and then made one run. He was one of the only ones to pass horses late and win on that card at Aqueduct on Saturday. Was relatively impressive visually from that standpoint, knowing the way the track was playing. However, so that's the plus. However, he ran down a maiden.
That's right.
He earned an 87 buyer, which yes. doesn't really stack up very favorably against some of the other Derby contenders, and certainly doesn't stack up very well against even his own owner's horse, Mohamed, who is
the current number one. Or number one.
You know, but it does set Shadwell up to have a couple really good runners, and regardless of whether or not the figure comes back well or what you think of it, he's going to be in the Derby if he stays healthy.
There's a lot of positives about Shagoff. You know, granted, yeah, he did save ground on the rail, so that was one advantage he did.
I mean, on the backstretch,
right. I think yeah. Red Ortiz did a nice job in that. But then he did make a move on the outside, and he did close on the outside to get up for the win. But granted, he was going against the maiden, so
yes.
a horse that might have just been, you know, tiring and is up against it. But another thing in Shagoff's favor is his pedigree. Mm-hmm. This horse is out of Muhawara, and Muhawara is from the same family as El Defar.
Okay.
He won the marathon
right.
In the Breeders' Cup. Basically, what I'm saying is this horse could run all day.
Sure.
And he's by
Bernardini.
And so the longer they go,
yeah.
he's going to get better.
Yep.
I mean, the one thing you know about this horse, he could do it a mile and a quarter in his sleep. Okay. so yeah. that there's no questions about distance with him.
Right.
Granted, you're going to want to see a quicker race going into the yeah. Derby. You don't really want a horse with a top of 88, and that was his maiden
mm-hmm.
winner.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of equaled that in this race. But again, much like we were talking about with Sophia.
Catherine Sophia. Yep.
He has done nothing wrong in his career. He's
sure.
3-for-3. He's won
yep.
all of his races. He's done what he's had to do. And this one probably posed the biggest obstacle to him based on the fact that he had to make some of the moves on a track which was against his favor in terms of bias.
So you make a fair point. This was his third career start. He'll probably get one more prep, I'm guessing the wood for
yeah,
him.
I think so.
Shadwell will probably keep him separated from Mohamed. Mohamed is targeting yeah. the Florida Derby. They'll probably keep Shagoff, or however you say it, up in New York for the wood. If they meet, it will probably be in the Kentucky Derby. So that will be his fifth career start, the Derby, that is.
That's right.
And that could be, you know, I mean, maybe we've got a horse who's just going to be peaking at the right time, depending upon what he does in the wood. Maybe he's a little interesting and certainly is going to be a lot less getting a lot less attention than
but he's not going to get any money if he doesn't get any faster.
Right, right.
If his buyers don't
right.
get any higher.
That's
you
true.
Know, the money tends to go to the top figs. So no matter how visually impressive a horse looks, if he's coming in with a 90 buyer and other horses are running close to 100, he's not going to get bet. Which, you know, knowing he can go the distance, you hope for a breakdown. But he's at tactical speed, so it's not going to be a breakdown kind of race.
Like the three-year-old fillies, we had the case on Sunday where there was a three-year-old male who ran a better and faster race, at least on the buyer figures, than the stakes winner. And I'm talking about on Sunday at Aqueduct, Matt King Cole.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know if you watched the race, Lonnie, but, you know, and I don't know if the track was playing quite as speed-favoring and quite as crazy as the way it was on Saturday, but he laid down pretty significant early fractions. He disposed of Mo Power, who was a horse for Todd Pletcher that had been entered in the Gotham and had to scratch because there's a rule that you can't cross-enter into a
right.
later one. So anyway, he was getting some early pace pressure from that horse. Was under a total drive to try, and he really could make up no ground against Matt King Cole. He held off the favorite in the race, My Man Sam, who was running a bit late. Opened up against him and then was a bit geared down, maybe not completely geared down towards the wire, but won with open lengths in his first start since his maiden win, which came last October. They're thinking the wood for this one as well. He got a 97 buyer in here, and let me note, that's faster than any of the Kentucky Derby points races prior. Because
mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a different kind of race. It was an easier race for him. And he was tiring late. It wasn't a situation
well,
where
he needed the race.
Yeah.
Because he hadn't raced in 4 months.
He was tiring late. He had it his own way. It was not the same on Sunday as it was on Saturday as far as the bias goes. I watched every race on Sunday as well as on Saturday, and I took notes for them. And I was actually pretty impressed with my man Sam as well. I thought both of these horses, if you're gonna like Matt King Cole in that race, I think you have to like my man Sam. So
sure.
Going forward, I think these two horses are both worth watching, not just Matt King Cole. And like you said, Matt King Cole needed the race, so it'll be interesting to see what he does next time out. I imagine they will go to a stakes. He deserves it.
He
earned the right, yeah. As did my man Sam. So these are two horses that can move up going at the stakes company next time out, and they're worth really watching in terms that they need the points to get in, and their talent I think is you know I think they showed definitely you know some good signs of being talented and horses who could contend in this Triple Crown if they can get over the hump.
At the same distance on the same surface one day later, mm-hmm. He got a buyer speed figure 10 points higher than what Chagoff got in the Gotham. And ran faster.
I would watch those figures. You know how buyers sometimes will adjust figures
afterwards.
And
that's
fair. I'm not talking about the figures for my Matt King Cole and my man Sam. I'm just wondering if they're going to adjust the Gotham figures.
Bring Chagoff.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. And if that's the case, the way to look that up is if you have DRF Plus, you go to the winner's books or whatever. Just check them later on because if they make a change, you will see it. You know.
Right.
And so I'm going to probably check in a week or so just to see if they adjust that figure.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Matt King Cole did, I think in his maiden win, the race prior in October, I think his buyer figure was in that mid-90s range. So
I think it was 93.
Okay.
Yeah.
So improved a little bit. Granted, it's you know he's now a 3-year-old.
Yeah, he's run 93 as a 2-year-old is very impressive.
Right. Exactly. It was one of those races that made people think that he could be a player. I think I don't know what his deal was. He obviously had a few issues because he hasn't raced in 4 months. They're kind of up against it from a clock standpoint because he'll only have one more race before the Kentucky Derby. That is the Wood. He needs points in order to qualify for the Derby because he has not yet raced in any races.
Right. And that's going to go for my man Sam as well. So these are horses who basically, they're the horses to watch. They have more on the line. That's why sometimes when you see a Chagoff come back and he's got enough points, you have to think of the ultimate goal.
Yes.
You know, so sometimes you're just trying to get a race into him. I mean, it would be nice if Tim could go faster to say that he belongs, but at the same time, the ultimate goal in this case is the Derby. So for these horses, it's all or nothing.
Yeah, and it's just one that's interesting to watch going forward because he might be a little under the radar. I know he was a little bit of a hype horse off that maiden win, but without the Derby points, he may be a little overlooked. And in fact, I think this allowance win was impressive enough that they've added him to the third and final of the Kentucky Derby future wagers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he was in the field prior, so if you bet the field, you've got him covered, albeit at a much shorter price than he'll likely be in the third future book. All right, we've got a few minutes before Mr. Kenny Peck joins us. Let's talk real quickly. The DRF Players Podcast is sponsored by DRF Bets.
Yeah.
You are very, of course, familiar with DRF Bets as the lead
player development director.
And
you know, if you join DRF Bets now, you get you can get a $200 bonus, DRF SB 200. You just bet $50 the first day you join, then another $100, and you're going to get $200.
That's
great.
$200
wagering credit, boom, it's just free money. And I there's no reason not to do it. None.
None.
I mean, I'll take $200 any day of the week. Just add it to my bankroll. I have to bet. I'm going to bet anyway. So what difference does it make? There's absolutely no reason not to join.
When we're done, I'll give you my username. You can add 200 to my account, too.
Well, I think you're a member of DRF Bets.
That's true. I am.
But so you'll have to take advantage of some of the other promos we have along the way and the new rewards program.
I think we do have a – stay tuned. If you're a DRF Bets member already, we have a promo coming up this weekend for the big cap. Think it is going to be double odds on whatever horse you like in the big cap. More details coming soon on that. But of course, the other thing DRF Bets members get is free DRF PPs.
That's right.
Free
DRF Plus if you bet like 300.
Free DRF Plus, yeah.
And actually for those, we have a new rewards program coming out in April. And if you bet anything, you get free DRF Plus. And there's a lot of good supplemental handicapping information at DRF Plus, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. Bet $2
$2
in 1 month.
$2.
And that's enough.
Yeah.
You get free DRF Plus. All right. We've got Kenny Peck on the line. Welcome, Kenny. Welcome to the DRF Players Podcast. This is Mike Hogan. You're here also with Lonnie Goldfeder.
Hey, Kenny.
What's up, guys? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, good to have you. It's been a while. I don't know if you've ever been on the Players Podcast, have you?
I have not. I've never had the pleasure.
Well, welcome. Thank you for joining us. What we do, since this is your first time, one of the things we like to do on the podcast is put you on the spot a little.
Sure.
You know, certainly anybody that reads DRF, anybody that follows your picks, your selections, is familiar with you as a handicapper. But let's talk a little bit about how you got first interested in horse racing and what led you to become a handicapper and just kind of your background in racing.
Oh, boy. Well, I like to go to, like most of us who get involved in horse racing, I like to go to the track as a kid with my dad in Jersey. I think my first trip to Monmouth Park, I was six, and I hid in the trunk. All the adults were saying I couldn't come, and then my uncle allowed me to hide in the trunk for a short ride down to Monmouth.
Stole away.
Love it.
But you can't get away with that now. This is back, I guess, it was 1973. But after that, I always maintained an interest in racing, and then when I went to college, I was sports editor of the paper at Montclair State College in Jersey, and I started writing about horse racing. Not that anybody at the college cared about it, but I wanted to get clips from when I came out so I can send them to the Star Ledger and the Daily Racing Form and everybody else, so I'd have some type of portfolio. And that led to a job with a fledgling company called Figs Form that lasted about 6 months, but that then led into Racing Times. So I've been doing this since 1989.
Wow.
That's when I started. Racing Times folded. I ended up going to Delaware Park to be the public track handicapper there, making the odds and selections for a couple of years. That led to a job at Monmouth and then Meadowlands, and then I came to the Form in 95.
So you're a guy who had it set from the beginning. You knew exactly what you wanted to do.
I did, yeah. You know, grew up in Hoboken, used to drink beers on the piers back when they had piers before they built million-dollar condos, and my buddies and I would talk about what we wanted to do, and I was 15, and I said, I want to be the best handicapper to come out of Hoboken, because there was a couple of guys that played.
You're like Frank Sinatra, the best singer, and now you're the best handicapper.
I wouldn't go that far.
You're the Frank Sinatra of horse racing. Let's go.
Well, for the Hoboken part's about it, yeah.
I love it. Well, welcome, Kenny. We got a lot to talk about today. Of course, the big news and the big, largest portion of what we're going to discuss today has to do with Pace Ace. And this is your brainchild. This is something that I know is new to the DRFPPs and is new to anybody that's been following the racing form over the last week. But this is something that you've been working on for quite a while.
Yeah, this is the way I've handicapped for a long time. I always wanted to find an edge that was not in the PPs, and I always felt that race flow was one of the main things. You know, everybody talks about, like, you know, the running line never tells you how the race shaped up, right? Was it a wire-to-wire winner? Was it three speeds and a horse closed? And you could tell something from the fractions, but, you know, many times you can't. And I keep a lot of notes on tracks that I play with race flows in them, in addition to trying to make my own figures for some tracks. And that has led me to a lot of long shot plays and a lot of long shot winners, because it's something that's not available to the general public, not even racing form readers, but really any past performances. It's hard to pick up race flow. Sometimes it's very subtle, and you have to handicap the race yourself and keep detailed notes. The problem with it is it's extremely time consuming. It's a really laborious process, and it's hard to do for more than one or two tracks. And what Pace Ace does, it scales it across all tracks, and it makes it available to everybody just by buying the racing form. And it's unique to Daily Racing Form readers.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about what it is and how people can use it and how it shows up in their PPs. Because I know there's been a lot of confusion for some people, you know, and I've even seen some people say, well, I can see the fractions. I don't need to know whether it was a slow or fast race because the fractions are going to tell me that.
Well, the fractions could be, as you know, you guys know, the fractions could be misleading. Yeah. It depends on the speed of the track, obviously, how fast the fractions are. But even beyond that, a lot of times the fractions are misleading. And I'll tell you how the whole thing works from the beginning. What we do is we look at a field prior to the running of a race after scratches. So the fielder heads into the gate. The computer program looks at what type of race we can expect this to be. So it looks at all the horses' running styles and determines, can we expect this to be a race that favors speed horses or closers? Or is it a neutral race? With that pre-race designation, which is internal, we take it to the chart process after the race is run. And if the pre-race label matches how the race was run, then we have a label to put going forward on that race. So in other words, if there's a race, we expect not a lot of speed in it. We looked at the race prior to the race. We have an algorithm that calculates pace points in the race, depending on horses' running styles. If the pace point figure is low, we don't think there's a lot of speed in the race. We expect the speeds to have the edge. If the race is then run that way, a two-speed exacta, a loose speed with the second chasing speed finishing third, you know, whatever it may be, then we're comfortable saying, okay, this was a race that figured to favor speed horses, and it did, and we put the label on it. We do not do it unless it matches both pre- and post-race assessments. It doesn't change. It doesn't say, okay, well, now this race became a plus-speed race. No. The reason we did that was we're trying to find extreme examples and examples that were you know, in our mind, as ironclad as you could be for an automated process. So it's not... Mm-hmm. It's not something where it's subjective at all. It's right. We expect this prior, and then we have to have the check with the chart afterward. And that's why I'm comfortable with putting the data out there, because of that chart check.
Yeah, and so you bring up a good point. When you say it's looking at the running style and of recent history running style of all the horses in the race, and seeing, you know, look, are all these runners ones that seem to want the lead, or is it a field seemingly devoid of early speed? That is done completely separate to the race flow afterwards. You do it once before, you do it once after. You don't even need, the timer could malfunction. You might not get any early races. We've seen some issues, shall we say, at Gulfstream Park with the timer in the running of the race. If the timer malfunctions, Pace still works. It doesn't need those fractions at all in order for the system to identify whether it's an early speed race or a closer race, right?
Absolutely correct. Both are done independently. The pre-race and the post-race are done independently, but then they have to match. If they match, then we know we're onto something, and we feel comfortable putting it into putting a label onto that race.
So this is purely based on race shape, right? So class wouldn't matter. So a contested pace at a maiden claiming 10, and then the horse is going up to say he's going up in class to an open 25 or something like that. So even if he's coming out of contested, if they're coming out of contested races where it looks like that, and they're all coming out of cheaper races, or some's coming out of cheaper races, some are coming out of bigger classes. It's just purely on the shape of the race. Class does not factor into this at all.
No, it's running styles, and then if the running styles do match. Now, it wasn't. Listen, this took a long time. I mean, there's so many, as you guys know, there's so many variables. You know, we had to incorporate blinkers, we had to incorporate posts, we had to incorporate horses stretching out, turning back, surface switches. So it was a lot that goes into this. So the thinking behind making the pre and post match was, we want this to be right. And, you know, we don't want to just put information out there and say we think this. We don't think anything. This is how the race was run. So it's as objective as possible because of the chart check. And I've had people say, well, why don't we publish the pre-race stuff? Well, the pre-race stuff is based on an algorithm, which is very good, but there's no check for it. There's no. I'd like to have... The fact that we have the chart check makes it very much less subjective than it would otherwise. I'm not saying it's not something you could put it out there, but I don't want to put anything out there that has any kind of margin, a great margin of error.
Well, you have a checks and balances, so to speak, which is
absolutely
good.
And this is something that's new, of course, to many of the readers and many of the listeners, because they hadn't heard about it until last week. But this is something that I know you've been working on with the DRF team and the Jockey Club for a while now. And yeah. You haven't just looked at a handful of races and said, okay, it's ready to go, let's add it to the PPs. You've been working on this for years, right, Kenny?
I think we started doing it, we came up probably 2.5 years ago, and
yeah.
we had to... Like I said, there was a lot that went into the proofing, the checking, the QA of it, and then all the variables that went into it, and then of course the testing process and all that stuff. It's been going on for a couple of years at least.
I think any time you could actually come up with something which goes against numbers, because so many handicappers mm-hmm. basically use the fractions, any kind of number to decide what they're going to wager. Anytime you can go against the grain like that, you're actually, if it works, you're clearly giving yourself an advantage.
Yeah, anything that nobody else has and it's good quality yeah. information is going to give you an edge. And it gives you an edge in a couple of different ways. First, you know, the way I handicap a race is, as I always have, is you look at the race law of today's race first. You're looking for speed, how's it going to develop? And then by using pace ace, you can go back and look and say, hey, I looked at this race and I thought this horse was probably going to come from off the pace, but he's got a couple of H's there. He's coming out of races where there was a lot of speed in the race. He wasn't able to get to the front. That's a horse you can expect maybe he's going to be closer today if the race flow isn't going to be another H type of race. So those types of things.
Good. I'm sorry. I was going to say, there was a race that I guess you addressed actually on social media about in Santa Anita from March 26th, where the fractions were 21 and 2, 44, 56, 110, and it was listed as very slow. Could you explain maybe to our viewers, you know, why that was listed as such?
And this is the Brother Soldier race, I think, if you remember correctly.
Yeah, if you remember. I think the problem is, and I understand it completely, is the S being very slow and slow. Like it's, you know, the names are a bit of a misnomer because it really, if you want to think of it a different way, think of it as speed, like very speed favoring or speed favoring S and then the inverted S. And then the hot pace thing was debated internally because we're trying to like tell people what they're looking at. So we say hot pace, but it may not necessarily mean fast fractions. It means right. A race that's set up for closers. So what's the best way to impart that to the readers? And we figured like our hot H, you know, that's what comes across. Maybe that was that a mistake in putting H. I don't know, you put something otherwise, something in place of that. I don't know. But if you look at it in terms of race though instead of fractions, then I think you have a much better grasp of it. In terms of that race Saturday, yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. This is a race that didn't have a lot of pace in it, the race that the horse came out of. It was best 2 minutes was the horse, the first race at Santa Anita. Coming out of a race on June 14th, as I look it up quickly. Mm. The race, that was a good example, because if you look at best 2 minutes last couple of previous races, every single one of them were races where he was off the pace, except for his debut race. He was okay. In a couple of races, he was even going longer. Now suddenly, best 2 minutes is head and head through 21 and 3 first quarter, 44 and 4 half, and it's like, where did the speed come from? Well, in a race that's a paceless race, somebody's got to make the lead. And that doesn't necessarily mean that horse all of a sudden is a speedball. A lot of times it's because there's nobody else for the lead, or in this particular case, Tyler Bates, the jockey, went gunning for the lead. There's no way, obviously, to quantify that. There's no way to guess in advance if Tyler Bates is going to go gunning for the lead. But what I'm saying is that when you see a horse who all of a sudden is on the lead and the prior races had never been near the lead, you could pretty much guess that was probably a paceless race. It's a pretty good guess. If you look at the feel for that particular race, there really wasn't a lot of pace in the race. But we're so accustomed to seeing 21-3 and equating that to a fast pace, you say, well, how could that be? How could there be no speed in the race if this horse went 21-3? It's ridiculous. It's really not. I mean, the fact that Tyler Bates went gunner for the lead and another horse fell out for the lead and they went 21-3, it just happens to mean that, you know, in this particular case, they went for the lead. But the fact that there was no speed in the race stands. There really wasn't any pace in the race. And the fact this horse was on the lead tells you that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. And the way the light bulb kind of clicked for me was when, you kind of mentioned a little bit about the symbols being a little bit of a misnomer. And the way it clicked for me was thinking about not whether it was a fast or slow pace, but looking at it from, did this race favor those on or near the lead, or did this race favor those coming from well off the pace, or was it neutral? And I think any horse player can understand, even with a hot pace, it can still favor those on the lead. Even a slow pace can still favor those from coming off the pace. And I think once I changed the way I was interpreting these symbols and looking at these symbols, then it became less of an issue for me thinking, oh, well, you know, how can you have a very slow 21 and 2, 44 flat? No, it was more just a race that favored those on or near the lead.
But I could also see what right. You're talking about, because I, like you, take a lot of notes, and I have seen races where horses will run like 48-49, but it could be a very uncomfortable 48-49. Yeah. And that's because it's kind of like you're between horses, or everybody's, it's a contested pace, and the shape of the race makes it an uncomfortable situation for those horses. and hence they're going to fold at the end because they've been under a lot of pressure, despite the fact that the fractions might not have been that fast. That happens more maybe with a lower class, but that said, an uncomfortable trip could also translate, I think, into what you're talking about with race shape.
Yeah, you know, and that said, I should say Wayne Crimi is the guy at the Racing Form who was the one who was really the brains behind it. He wrote most of the code for it, and he's a horse player himself, but he's also a very knowledgeable guy when it comes to computers, which I am not. But he also was able to build something into it when we talked about this particular scenario. There's something built in for, like, exceptional cases in terms of the fractions where we're not going to have, you know, a 20 and 2 be a inverted S. 22 first opening quarter. Like there's something built in for exceptional fast fractions that Wayne put into it. So there can be a case where a race does. It probably would not go from one designation to another, but it probably would erase the designation if the race was too fast or too slow. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
In other words, if it was supposed to be a inverted H and the race came up and then they went 25 and 50 flat, then the program would end up taking the race down because it was super, super slow. If the race shaped up a certain way, it takes it to a different level within the algorithm.
No, that makes sense. And Wayne is Wayne's one of the smarter guys I know here. So, and I've talked to him a lot about it. I think he was the one I actually had the discussion with that made me start thinking of it in those ways. It's not necessarily about the fractions. We have Moss pace figures for that sort of thing. And Wayne's point was, I think, a really good one. When you see it come up as a hot pace here, and then when you use Formulator to see that Moss Pace has the race also deemed a plus race or a hot pace race, that's when you have that kind of convergence, that's when you really know that it is that both of the systems are working in conjunction with each other, and that's when you're going to find these overlays and these horses who are really running better efforts than what it appears on paper.
Yeah, Pace Ace does complement the Moss figures very well. They work very, very well together. But they are separate. They are definitely separate things. You have to think of Pace Ace as a race flow tool. Moss figures are obviously a pace figure tool. There are a lot of different tools we all use in handicapping, but Pace Ace is not a pace figure. Pace Ace is a race flow, pace scenario type of tool that until now has not been seen. I don't think anybody has them in their PPs, and it's something that was frankly lacking for somebody like me who's a pace player. Now we can tell more about a race than we ever were able to tell before.
Right. Well, and I think the thing that it makes it different from any of the other products out there is that pre and post check. I mean, many of them will look at the race flow or fractions and determine whether it was one that favored closers or speed horses. But to my knowledge, no product does what you're talking about, Kenny, where you're looking at the race prior and looking at the race after and doing that validation.
I tell you, that would have been the easy way out. I kind of wish we could talk. It would have been a much easier way to do it, but it would not have been as good a product to look at the race afterward and say, hey, this race, I mean, that's kind of simplistic to say.
It's the same due diligence the buyers do when they review their figures. At least we're reviewing the legitimacy of the notation, and I think that's important.
Yeah, but anybody can look at a race and say, oh, the two speeds went 1-2 here. It's got to be a race of favorite speed. Not necessarily. I mean, they may have outrun two other speeds to get loose on a lead, and that doesn't show up in the past performance line anywhere. So you need to look at the composition of the field prior to assessing whether a race favored speed or closers.
Right. Now,
I find rating a race after handicapping it is very important. So
just
otherwise you're taking it out of context. So knowing what's supposed to happen as opposed to what does happen, you know, you're it's a more three-dimensional view of the notation as opposed to being two-dimensional.
No doubt, and you know how time-consuming that is to do.
It's extremely time-consuming. Yeah. Trust me, nobody knows better. You know, I'm writing an article right now which is based on that very thing.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, because that's the thing. We've all handicapped the race prior, and we're saying, okay, speed horse, speed horse, speed horse, speed horse. You know, this race is going to be set up for closers. But then in the reality, you could have one of the horses unprepared for the start. You could have one of the horses having blinkers taken off because the trainer wants to train them to do something differently, and they told the jockey to take them back. You can have another horse that stumbles at the start, and all of a sudden you've really only got one horse that's going to be showing any early speed at all. So there are so many factors, and that's what makes this game so difficult, is that there's no magic bullet.
You know, it's funny that Wayne had to straighten me out a few times during this process where I'd say to him, Wayne, this is completely wrong. I had this. He's like, well, you know, and he's kind of gentle about it. He's like, you know, maybe you're not always right.
You know, like, no, you're always right. Wait, Kenny Peck, I know, was always right. I don't get that.
I mean, but, you know, I'm like, here's my chart book. I can show you. And, you know, you break down the race and say, here's what happened. And that's exactly to your point. You know, a horse breaks slowly, or a horse is taken back intentionally, or you know, it could be a number of factors.
Well, it's nothing more frustrating than projecting a number of speeds, and then your speed horse either doesn't break or is at the back of the. It happened this weekend, you know, with was the Big Deluxe. He doesn't get out of the gate, and then the little Popsy is loose. I mean, it happens all the time. So if you had a race like that, I would imagine. Since the way that race developed, okay, so you were supposedly on paper, you were going to have two legitimate speeds going to the lead together, creating what was supposed to be a speed duel, and one of them doesn't break. In a case like that, did you just make it a neutral race and forget about it?
Well, probably, if there was two speeds in the race, it would probably be enough to say it's a possible age race. I don't know offhand whatever else is in the race, but if it's just two pure speeds like that, probably will be considered an H if the race did fall apart. If one doesn't break and the other one gets loose on a lead, of course it's going to be downgraded to a neutral, no doubt about it.
Right, that's what I would think, because that's what happened, and once the other horse is not there, it's over. Yeah. You know, that was on the day of that crazy bias in New York, but if both horses at least dueled, somebody else might have had a chance.
Well, that's the other thing about putting the pre-race stuff is that, you know, I hate to put that out there, and then you have, all it takes is one, you guys know, it takes one key scratch of a pace horse and the whole complexion changes. So, mm-hmm. you know, to put that out there and it would mislead people who don't realize, like, the scratch of this seemingly no-hope long shot really changes everything because he was going to pressure the favorite, and now all of a sudden the expected race flow is different. So you got to be real careful with that stuff. You know, it's one thing to be doing it by hand like we do, and you're looking at one particular circuit, and we see that race, and Lonnie, you see that race, and you know going forward, you make a note, and you say, you know, this horse didn't break, this horse ended up getting loose, right. And they got lucky. When you try to automate that process and do it for every track, you know, it's a very slippery slope, and you got to be real careful with what you're putting out there.
Well, and in your article, and if anybody that hasn't seen the video that is embedded in the article about Pace Ace, I after this, take the time. It's about 10 minutes. It's you and Dan Illman talking about it. Gives a lot of really good examples and goes into depth about what we're talking about here with some good visuals. But in the article and in the video, you talk a little bit about using this tool to kind of question, using it in conjunction, say, with the buyer speed figures and question maybe a high buyer that was earned because the horse was benefited from race flow. And that's, frankly, the ability to knock a short-priced favorite is as valuable as it is pushing you towards a winner, right?
Sure. I mean, that's a great point. And you'll see that both sides. You'll see a huge buyer, and you'll be like, where did this come from? And this could add context to that. If you see the favorable race flow, that's an easy way to explain something like that. And a lot of times I hear people talk about bounces and horses coming off layoffs and the second time back. You know, I found a lot of time that's pace related, and you'll see a horse come back in a favorable spot and run a huge figure, and next time comes back in an unfavorable pace scenario, and then bounces, so to speak.
When you're going really fast, it takes a lot out of you. I mean, early, because it is a lot of impact and wear and tear from that.
But you do see a lot of that. You see big buyers that could be explained away, and you can also see poor buyers, which you know obviously we're more interested in, because a poor buyer, if you can find an excuse for it, you have more confidence in expecting the horse to run back to his better figures in the past. And this is a legitimate and prior to the advent of pace flow, was unknown excuse for these horses. Pace is a legitimate excuse just as much as a check or a slow start is.
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a race on Monday, the Nightcap at Parks, that I kind of mentioned to you via email, where the horse that ended up going off at 1-2 as the favorite coming off of a Pace Ace marked slow last out effort where he set the early lead before tiring and finishing third, beaten four lengths, earned the top buyer in the field, but now was facing a field full of seemingly more early speed. did the exact same thing on Monday in that nightcap, set an early lead, tired at 1-2, and finished third, allowing a, I think it was 13 or 12-13-1 horse to win. If you're able to identify and knock those kinds of horses at odds of 1-2, that's what tips you towards being able to actually make a profit in this game.
Absolutely. That's one of the key uses for it, is to find vulnerable favorites. And you're going to find a lot of them with this. And, you know, listen, some of them are going to win because they're going to be in the proper spot or just be just too good for that field. But you're going to find a lot of horses that you can bet against, and you're going to find a lot of explanations for poor performances or for big performances that you can say, going forward, I can make money off this situation, because this is what was pointed out by this tool.
All right, Kenny, we only have a couple more minutes left. I want to mention a couple other things that are coming up. I know these currently, Pace Ace is currently only in classic PPs and in the digital paper or the actual printed paper. In the near future, maybe the next few weeks or so, hopefully they'll be in Formulator as well, so you really can get the full use of them where you dive into those race charts, you look at them versus the Moss Pace. So I'm excited for that. When that happens, you and I will sit down and have a nice webinar, too, where we can go through and show a bunch of examples, and anybody listening can come with their questions, try and pick it apart, really try and tear you down. I know you'll have answers for all of them. So I'm looking forward to that. That's something that's going to be coming in the next few weeks.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. I think, in closing, if people... You're going to get a lot of use out of it, and you're going to be ahead of the curve with a lot of it. Just if people think of it as with the S for speed, if it's S favors speed, whether it's inverted or not, and then the H is, if you get away from the hot fractions thing and think pace. H is for closers, benefit if it was against his speeds. You think of it that way, just get away from the fractions thought of it, and I think everybody will have a better time understanding it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Kenny. It's a pleasure having you on the podcast. I hope we have you on again sometime soon, especially once Monmouth kicks off. I'd love to have you on.
That'd be great. Thanks, boys.
All right, Ken. Take care, man.
Take care, guys.
All right. All right, Lonnie. We're out of time.
Okay.
It was a fun podcast.
Yes,
thank you, as always, for joining.
My pleasure. Also, Kenny Peck was the inventor of the Quick Sheets, by the way, too, for those who don't know. So he's kind of unknown for certain things.
He is. Yes. A lot of DRF product development
exactly.
in with Kenny. He's always thinking about ways to make the product better, mm-hmm. which is good.
That is true.
All right. Well, thank you for watching today's podcast. I'll be back in studio on Friday, joined remotely by Mr. Jonathan Kinchin and Mr. Peter Thomas Forinatel. Until then, enjoy the Matt Bernier show. He's coming on next. A DRF. You can watch it on podcast as well.
He's coming
on
now.
He's coming in. He's kicking us out. He's coming in right now.
Is he got Don Rickles on today?
He might have Don Rickles.
Okay,
you'll have to tune
be great.
In.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. He's only on Friday.
So Don Rickles has to go home.
Don Rickles will be on Friday.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Lonnie, and thank you for watching, and we'll be back Friday.
All right.